Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Dusty White, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune of Cormdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. On Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about the antisocial century.
This is the cover article from the February 2025 issue of The Atlantic. One thing you guys need to know about editors is that they love, you know, headlines are the thing. Titles are the thing. So like they want to make the headline the most provocative thing. So I don't know. The antisocial century feels like a pretty, we're talking about a hundred year period of time here.
It's not a decade, folks.
But that's the article. By the way, this is a little interesting tidbit on The Atlantic. Chris, you and I both have paper copies. Are you a subscriber?
First City Church is.
Okay. Yeah. So I've subscribed to The Atlantic for a while just to try to do reading and cultural topics. Sometimes they're really balanced. Sometimes they're pretty left skewed. But here's what's interesting. The Atlantic announced just this past month that they're going back to a every month publication. Back in like the early 2000s, they shrunk down to 10 times a year. And it was back when everybody was worried that like tablets and the internet and online magazines were going to kill print subscriptions. And so all the print people got super nervous and they were trying to dial back how much they were spending on making physical copies of magazines. And The Atlantic basically announced, actually our physical subscriptions are thriving, and so much so that we're going back to a monthly publication, which I thought is good news. In a digital world, it's good to see artifacts thriving.
Mm-hmm. My kids, when they get the mail, they're like, "Dad, your magazine came." Yeah. They're like excited, you know.
Yeah. Like, it's like a real artifact. So this article is by Derek Thompson. He's naming something that I think has significant impact for Christians in general and for the church. And you can probably intuit what that is. It's about, you know, the epidemic of sort of loneliness, isolation, solitude. That's kind of the broad topic here. That's why he titled it The Antisocial Century. And as we talk about this, I want to sort of talk about it in three categories. I want to talk about the what. I'm just going to overview some of the statistics he's tracking in this article. I want to talk about the why he suspects, and the people he interviews for this article suspect, that these things are happening. And then the now what. And in each of those categories, there might be opinions we have or more things for us to sort of digest together. But for listeners, I think this is, you know, this is the world we live in. And so this affects your neighbors, your family, your friends, your own church community. We just live in a world where people are a bit more isolated than they have been in a long time. And we need to think about the implications of that for our own lives and for one another. So let me read you a few of the stats in this article. One of the things I like about the writers in The Atlantic is they do try to do a good job sourcing their assertions in good data. And so here's a few of the data pieces that this article lays out. In 2023, get this, guys, 74% of all restaurant traffic came from off-premises customers. That is from takeout and delivery, which is up from 61% before COVID, which I thought 61% is even high.
Yeah, that still seemed really high.
It's like, man, 3 out of 4 customers are just grabbing a bag from the restaurant and taking it home.
I was at a restaurant recently with a guy, and there's probably 12 people in there, but there's probably 15 to 20 bags in the takeout area ready to rock.
So that's the new norm. Here's another stat. The share of U.S. adults having dinner or drinks with friends on any given night has declined by more than 30% in the past 20 years. A third, I guess this is less of a stat and more of his thesis statement, a summary of the stats. He writes, Americans are spending less time with other people than in any other period for which we have trustworthy data, going back to 1965. So that's the assertion of the article, is we're just spending less time with others than we have in my lifetime and beyond. A few more stats in the article. From 1965 to 1995, the typical adult gained 6 hours a week in leisure time. You know what we do with that extra 6 hours? Watch more TV. That's the answer. And then, of course, since we now live in a smartphone era, the typical person is awake for about 900 minutes a day. American teenagers spend on average about 270 minutes a day on their screens. That's really discouraging to me. Mm-hmm. That means screens occupy more than 30% of their waking life. Dusty's shaking his head because we got some problems out there in the world.
Yeah. Y'all. And this is not virtue signaling at all, but I recently discovered that my 14-year-old daughter is the only one now in her class in eighth grade without a phone.
Yeah. Hey, good.
There was one other guy. There was one other boy, apparently. And then like he got one for his birthday or something. Darn it. So like she came home and told me all about it.
Bummer.
I don't feel like that's a big feat, you know? Like,
yeah, it should not 14. Be. Come yeah, on. That should not be difficult. A final stat, in the 1970s, the typical household entertained more than once a month. But from the late 70s to the late 90s, the frequency of hosting friends for parties, games, dinners, and so on declined by 45%. And since then, it's declined another 32%. So we used to have people over a lot and now we don't is kind of what these data are telling you. Now, again, you know, there's a famous phrase from Will Rogers, the humorist, that there's lies, there's damn lies, and then there's statistics. So, you know, do what you want. I'm sure Derek Thompson is pulling these stats. I'm sure you could find a dozen other stats that might, you know, complicate the picture a little bit, but it does seem pretty evident from all these data points that Americans are spending less time face-to-face with one another than we have in a long time. Any thoughts, guys?
It is interesting how on the other side of COVID that this has continued to trend where I would have perhaps guessed that we would have seen a spike in the other direction, but where he goes with the article, I think a bit later here, where he gets into kind of how we have maybe shifted our psychology of loneliness and what we do with loneliness, I think is interesting. But I'll admit when I read this, there's a piece of it that wasn't surprising, but then when you think about it, and why, when we had, you know, a year or so of having to being forced in our homes, couldn't be around each other, did we just kind of get comfortable with it rather than just like this huge pushback?
Let me give you the three pieces in Derek Thompson's article that he suggests play a role here. Quite simply, it's phones, homes, and rings. Let me build out each of those. Phones, he actually says there's three technologies in the last 100 years that have shaped us. One is the automobile, one is the television, and one is the smartphone. And he says what you notice, and this is a point that actually Andy Crouch makes as well in his book Culture Making, that every technology changes the world that we live in, right? So you think about how automobiles changed our lives. You know, once you can drive a car, well, you can spread out further. Cities can be bigger. You can live in the suburbs and still get to work. And so you notice this, in especially in American cities that were built after the invention of the automobile, they're very different geographically than Philadelphia or Boston or some of the cities on the East Coast that were built in the colonial era, right? There's just a different pattern. Secondly, television, which sort of got us used to coming home from a day at work or, you know, whatever, and like crashing and, you know, watching whatever on TV, that made a difference in how Americans spend their time. And then, of course, most recently, the smartphone has totally changed how we interact. And so he mentions in the article, you know, now we live in a world where you actually can be in a space where there's tons of other people. It's just they're all staring at their phone. You know, if you go to the doctor's office, no one's like trying to chat with you and be like, hey, Dusty, why are you here today? They're just all on their phone. So that's the first why that he points out, is just these technologies have changed our social expectations. If you're in a social environment waiting in line or something like that, and someone actually talks to you, it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Kinda like, why aren't you just on your phone, man? Like, you know,
it is weird. Like you're the weird person now. If you, if you talk to somebody in line, you know?
Yeah. Like what are you doing? Why are you talking to me?
Don't you have a phone? Yeah. Why are you talking to me?
I was just talking to a friend yesterday who was telling me about a new coffee shop that opened up, and they were like, I went to the old one. She was saying, there's a new coffee shop that opened. When the original version opened, she said, I went there and I walked in to meet with a friend, but everybody in there was on a laptop and they all looked up and like stared at me like, are you going to talk in here? Cause we're trying to get work done. And she was like, it was so awkward that I like, we got our coffee to go because I was like, well, I'm not going to sit in here and be the only person talking with all these people feeling weird about it. So it really is interesting how our social environment has changed.
Remember when you went to the doctor and you like, you sat there in the waiting room awkwardly and somebody talked to the person next to you, like about the weather, about the paper, about something.
And there was like always some lame magazines or like Ladies Home Journal or you know something like that where you're like, I guess you can flip through that if you want, but it's probably more interesting to talk to the person next to you. Okay, the second why here is homes. Adults in 2022 spent an additional 99 minutes at home on any given day compared with 2003. So in 20 years, an additional hour and a half spent at home. The researcher who originally tracked this assumed, well, it's because we're on the backside of COVID and everybody's doing remote work and, you know, people are just working from home more. But as he dug into the data, he says, this phenomenon cannot be reduced to remote work. It's something more like remote life. And what he's saying is, you know, our houses are bigger. They're more comfortable. We've built them in ways that, you know, you can be pretty comfortable hanging out at your house. You got different rooms. Your kids can be playing in one spot. You can be working on your work in another spot. You know, people, you have a huge television probably, and, you know, it's like nicer than a movie theater was 40 years ago. So his point is our homes have become so comfortable that people have begun to treat their homes more as like a retreat from the world or a place to go to sort of just be alone, rather than as a place to have folks over for dinner or, you know, practice hospitality. So this is a really discouraging feature that I'll read from the article. He talks to a person who helps to design apartments. And this person says the cardinal rule of contemporary apartment design is that every room is built to accommodate maximal screen time. In design meetings with developers and architects, you have to assure everybody there will be space for a wall-mounted flat-screen television in every room. It used to be, let's make sure our rooms have great light. But now the question is, how do we get a flat-screen TV in here? And I, you know what's interesting, Dusty, is like if you've ever been to an Airbnb house, like a house that's clearly made for Airbnbs, it's like this is what you notice is there is a television in every room in that place.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's kind of discouraging.
We're building for aloneness,
right?
That interview says.
Yeah, this is such an interesting point where you think of your home and family life as a retreat versus like the center of activity of life from which you go and kind of launches you out into the world. Mm. That's just, yeah, something has flipped in our psychology of how we view our homes and families. Yeah, it's an interesting thing.
And it's not all COVID's fault, but COVID did pave the way for it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's cool. Stay home. Okay, so phones, homes. The third point I mentioned is rings. And what he means here is like think about concentric circles of your relationships. So what he says is texting and social media has made our inner rings tighter and our outer rings. So it's funny, like think he says, he quotes this person in the article, it's like, hey, my wife and I have texted 10 times since I left the house today. Like I'm actually in closer communication with my family than I ever have been. I get a notification when my kid buys a candy bar at the store. You know, it's just like I can be very connected to my inner circle of family and people I'm really close to. And then that outer ring of people that are like, you know, this is a pastor across the country, but I just can text them and say, hey, how are things going? You know, it's you can maintain relationships that would have been very distant. You would have had to write a letter or pick up the phone and call, but now with texting and social media, you actually can maintain that wider circle of relationships in a more meaningful way. What's dying is what this author calls the middle ring, which is familiar but not intimate relationships. It's your neighbors, it's your village, it's the people in your town. It's just the people you come in contact with and would have sort of had a meaningful interaction with in the past, but now you don't because technology kind of kills that. So it's interesting that you see smartphones increasing our inner ring and our outer ring, but sort of disintegrating that middle ring, that sense of sort of the village that you belong to. And so this author suggests those three things, our phones, how our homes are built, and that decline of that middle ring of friendship is part of what's at the why behind this sort of antisocial century, but behind the fact that we're just less connected to other people than we once would have been. What are your thoughts, guys?
I also like his point there about you disagree with your neighbor, not because of a conversation, basically, but because of how they're posting online. And so it's still phone-based. There's still this barrier in place with your neighbor, but it's not because you had a meaningful conversation across the fence and had time to do that. You've just like made all these
on Facebook.
Yeah. You've seen their post. You've seen their yard signs. You haven't talked about it. And so like, it's more isolated there. Mm-hmm. Whereas like you're, you know, just a couple decades ago, our parents and grandparents would have had to have those driveway conversations and banter back and forth. And so that erosion, he's saying, is actually making us more polarizing too.
Yeah.
What's also interesting to me, kind of at a high level, is this is another one of those articles that show how when it comes to technology, that I think Christians and just human beings in general have, you know, just the wisdom aspect of this of, hey, just because something isn't wrong to use, it's not wrong. I mean, cars are good things. Homes are good things. You know, the smartphone can be for good things, that we're not always careful to consider how it is changing our lives and giving counterbalance to some of that, that we can just kind of uncritically adopt something because it is immediate, it's good, or, you know, it's not immediately wrong, or it provides these goods for us. And so one of the things that I was thinking is like, man, we just over and over and over again, I think this technological age that we live in, the fruit of that is showing us that, hey, we need to really be thoughtful about our adoption of technology. And even as we are implementing it, to always be critical, be slow, be thoughtful, and not just assume, hey, this is just going to be good and is only going to lead us to good things. Even if it's not disaster, I think our gauge is for this too. It's like, hey, we're not completely destroying ourselves, but maybe there are some other subtle things that over time will pop up. And so I think this is another one of those examples. The other thing, and maybe the thing that most stood out to me in this article, is how he highlights what we are doing with that sense of loneliness, to where he tries to draw a distinction between solitude and loneliness.
Good. I was going to get to that. So yeah. You can tell us about that.
Yeah. And this sense that, hey, sometimes solitude is a good thing, that we need time away to recharge, to kind of just be alone with our thoughts, kind of reconfigure. And then also even loneliness at times can be good because it can motivate us to go make those social connections. But what he's saying is that, so he's like, hey, there's this growing solitude that's happening, and maybe some of the registers of loneliness aren't necessarily spiking with that, which seems to indicate that what we're doing with our loneliness isn't what we have done in the past, where, hey, let's go out and make connections and meet people in order to deal with that. It's just more, I'm just going to be more, I'm fine with my solitude. I'm fine with disconnecting. And it's almost like we're becoming numb to loneliness in some ways, like in ways we should be responding to that. We're not. We're either coming to grips with it, or we're numbing it, or whatever it may be. But I thought that was pretty fascinating.
It is fascinating. And the other thing that we need to be aware of there too is, only in my loneliness or solitude, which would be a healthy loneliness or a retreat maybe, that's the only spot where my creativity or imagination has any space to do anything. I can't be creative or wonder if I have to be continually entertained.
Right? Yeah,
I have to be able to be alone. I have to be comfortable being alone.
Yeah, yeah. And we're not allowing that. We're filling it. We're crowding it. That solitude isn't actually, we're not getting the benefit of solitude.
The author of this article, you know, spends most of the article naming the problem and talking about it and sort of analyzing it. Only at the very end, in the last four or five paragraphs, does he say, hey, here's what we should do. This author clearly thinks that this is a problem we should solve, that it's moving us toward isolation, and that's not good for us. And like you mentioned, Dusty, it's complicating problems of political polarization. It's complicating problems of loneliness, like you just mentioned. There's adverse effects to us socially as a society because of this tendency toward antisocial or isolation types of behavior. What's interesting is he doesn't have a lot of prescriptions for like, what would you do? But one thing he names that I thought was really fascinating, let me read to you from, he names that this is a collective action problem. Mm-hmm. So what he means by that is, right, his example is a teenager is more likely to get out of the house if his classmates have already made a habit of hanging out. That teen's parents are more likely to host their neighbors if their neighbors have also made a habit of weekly gatherings. It's just easy. There's an inertia. When they talk about a collective action problem, it's exactly what you were saying with your daughter's smartphone, Dusty, of like, if everybody else in the class has one, it's tough for you to be the only parent saying you can't. But if all the parents band together and say, hey, it's a collective action, we're going to take phones away from our kids, then it's a lot easier for someone to opt into that. And so he's acknowledging that some of these realities are collective action problems. And here's what he names. There's a word for such deeply etched communal habits, rituals. And one reason, perhaps, that the decline of socializing has synchronized with the decline of religion is that nothing has proved as adept at inscribing ritual into our calendars as faith. There's his basic, I mean, without saying it, he's saying the church is actually one answer mm-hmm. to this problem. Mm-hmm. Faith, Christianity, religious communities are one answer, one solution to this problem.
Yeah, makes a good argument for just the ritual of gospel community. Like yep. after we're done recording, I'm heading to my gospel community. Something we do every week. And there is this built-in reality that there is one night every week where I know I'm not going to be alone. And sometimes I feel like showing up and sometimes I don't. But doing it connects me to a group of people that I do deeply love. But there's just something about that that is, it pulls me out of myself. It connects me. There is that sense that he talks about the neededness that we have that helps us connect to people, like those realities. So, you know, just talking about kind of the so what within the church, having, and you know, Sunday mornings is another piece of this, but being a church that creates rituals of thick community is one of the ways that the church can really push against this.
You're getting at exactly what I wanted to draw out, because this article to me is just like verification of something I try to say to our church all the time, which is just showing up matters.
Yeah. Yep. Just get in the room.
Sometimes Christians have this very idealistic sense of, in fact, I think Bonhoeffer talks about the way that idealism about community can destroy community, where it's like, man, if it's not like a life-changing gathering every week, then it's kind of a waste of my time. Mm-hmm. And I think I can fall into that way of thinking of like, man, if I'm going to be at a gospel community, I want it to be rich and I want it to be like really diving in with each other. I want it to like be meaningful. You know, like I can put all these burdens of expectation on what I want this gathering to be like. But to your point, Chris, actually what this article is reminding you is just having a night in your week when you get with some other people is a deeply formative pattern and is actually strengthening you and helping you in a bunch of ways you can't even measure. Just the ritual of showing up is doing something. And there's a collective action factor there. Like, and actually being part of a church that just says, hey, here's what we do. We're a church that has small groups and we expect folks to show up and be part of them. There's a collective action there that makes it easier, that builds some inertia, that helps pull us into that, and that actually helps to work against the tendency toward isolation. So the idea of ritual, the idea of pattern, I'm a creature of habit. So this is like something I care about just because I know that I'm wired this way personally. But one thing I've noticed, I say this often, Dusty, around here, is I lead our prayer meeting every Tuesday morning here at the church at 7 a.m. And the reason I do that is because I need it for my own soul. Like it's less about like I need to show up and lead a thing. It's more like I need that in my calendar to just get me in the habit of praying with other people regularly because I know it's good for my soul and it's doing something in me. And this idea of just building patterns in your life, building habits, building rhythms where it's like, I'm showing up to this thing, whether it's good, bad, or neutral, I'm just going to have it in the calendar. I think we underestimate the impact and the importance of that. And so one of the things that I was thinking about is back when our kids were young and we were planting a church and we were trying to have appropriate boundaries of, you know, how do I make sure that I'm, you know, home and present with my kids in the ways I need to be as a dad, but also that I'm available to the church in the ways that I need to be. And the way my wife and I chose to do that was we just sort of built a rhythm of like, hey, 3 to 4 nights a week, we're available. And then the other 3 to 4 nights a week, we're not available. So it depends on the week. Sometimes it's 3, sometimes it's 4. But like, we just always know like these 3 nights, I'm either at my own gospel community or we're having people over for dinner, or like we're doing ministry on these 3 nights. And then these other 4 nights, you know, are kind of devoted to us being home together, and especially bedtime and stuff like that. What that gave us was just like a pattern to just say, hey, if somebody asks like, hey, when can we get together? My answer is like, well, probably Monday night. 'Cause that's like when we have people over. That's like our night to have people over. And what that means is like, I'm not having people over 7 nights a week. So maybe, you know, maybe I'm being lazy and I'm a bad pastor. There was those kinds of voices in my head of like, maybe I should be doing that more. Maybe I'm not doing it enough. But at the very least, what it built was, but I know that there's like a, there's a habitual pattern in my calendar that allows me to practice hospitality, share the gospel, do discipleship, serve people. And it just did something profound for our kids to grow up in a household where that was just like rhythmic. It was just like, oh yeah, we always have a gospel community night. Dad's always gone to the elder meeting or something one night. And there's a night when we're having somebody over for dinner. And that's just kind of how our life works.
Another thing that I was provoked by was when he highlights the good that comes when we actually seek social interaction versus maybe just sort of retreating in ourselves. So, you know, riding the train or the bus, getting into a conversation rather than just kind of sitting with your thoughts, which again, is not wrong to do that. And sometimes you do need that, but I was provoked because I realized that's me. Like if I'm traveling, you know, flying some sort of public transportation where I'm not driving, I like to just sort of be alone with my thoughts. Or if I go to the grocery store, often I go to the you know, the self-checkout line and just thinking, how would it actually be good for us to choose social interactions, even those small little ones, to just train ourselves in being social connected creatures. And I even think like the grocery store is like 3 blocks from my house. So it's like a neighborhood grocery store. Like people that are in that grocery store live in my area.
Yeah.
So if I was more engaged kind of in those spaces, how would that just not help me form into just being more thoughtful and social and connected in other ways? And so, and I'm an introvert. So like for all the introverts listening, like I get it. Like sometimes you just need that time and it's fine to take, but how much better and easier does it become in some sense that if we're always choosing social connection, when we're able to, that those, you know, kind of ritual spaces that we enter into are going to be all the richer. So I think that's another small way in some ways, but I think an important way that we're just being conscious about choosing connection versus kind of isolation.
I have a word on that for all the curbside pickup people, because I have a lot of friends that do curbside pickup for basically everything. And the argument is always, I save money. Like if I go in the store, I'm going to buy more or, you know, spend too much. But again, like everything you just said makes a case for go in, meet the person who's checking out your groceries, who probably lives within 3 to 4 miles of you, and, you know, kind of preserve or conserve the fabric of that social engagement.
Yeah.
There's an interesting point in this article that I found fascinating, which was there's a study that showed if you call a friend on the phone, it's more meaningful than if you text them. And I was like, well, that's fascinating because texting is easier. Like sometimes it's like, yeah, sometimes it's like, well, I can just send a text real quick and then they can read it when they get to it. I'm not interrupting them. But what the article shows is, but actually when you call and someone hears your voice and you hear their voice, both people register that as a more meaningful encounter than just receiving a text. And it's because of what they call paralinguistic cues. It's all the nonverbals and the tone of voice and all that stuff that you pick up in a conversation. And so this article is just such an obvious reminder of so many things the Bible takes for granted, which is face-to-face community is good. Friendship is good. Rituals are good. Patterns in our lives that get us in the presence of other people are good. It's sort of just like verifying the Bible's wisdom. And I want Christians to hear it's verifying the things the church has always cared about. It's telling you these things aren't just good for you at a basic, you know, spiritual level. They're actually helping you flourish as a human being and probably filling up gaps you might not even realize that you had.
The other thing that this article highlights that I think is really important for Christians to be thinking about, especially Christian families and parents, and hey, I'm guilty right here of putting a ton of effort into family. And it's one of the things that I think the Lord has put me on the earth to do. But reading this article made me think, oh, that's an interesting thought, because he says in here that kids are now spending more time with their parents than with people their own age. And my comment in the margin was, well, that's interesting because the parents don't have any friends either, you know? So like, of course they are. And the thought I had there was like, well, they're just more comfortable there. But I think that can create, and I've seen some of this kind of happen around me lately in some pastoral conversations, is I think that can create a little bit of unhealthy dependence almost. Like the thing you really want is for your kids to grow up and become healthy adults. You don't want and who are good friends of yours, but you don't want them to be so dependent that they can't function in their own generation, right? And so I think we have to be pushing basically more interaction for our kids in their generations. And we have to model that with really healthy friendships. You know, like we have to have those people over to our dinner table and we got to interact and we got to be present.
Yeah. To kind of go back to what I was saying earlier too, that there is a sense in which our homes are our refuges. This is a place of where we come and we recharge and we're, you know, with our families, but for the purpose of then opening our home and going out. And so it becomes this launch pad for mission and relationship and hospitality. And so letting those times of a family time be energizing and strengthening for okay, now we're turning outward and now we're going to welcome in. And so those things interacting versus just, hey, we're going to retreat and seclude and just kind of hang out here. And, oh, I suppose we have to get out into the world, you know, kind of thing versus no, let's go be on mission. Let's invite people in.
So overall, I just really appreciate this article. It's a little lengthy. It is the cover story of The Atlantic, but it really does, I think, set the church up as you read it for a lot of mission. I think you're right. Like the church is positioned better than anything else in history and into the future for mission. I mean, it's just super clear in here that we are ripe with opportunity because we have the rituals, we have the truth, and we can create the thick community that the world needs.
So that's what I want listeners to hear is don't walk away from this like, oh man, yeah, here's some interesting data points about our society. I think there's ways you can listen to a podcast like this and just treat it as, okay, that's helpful sociological data. I think the more interesting thing here is the call to action this gives us as God's people to say, hey, practice hospitality, build rituals of community in your life, love and enjoy face-to-face interaction. Think about calling folks rather than texting them. Like just the little opportunities that God has given us to value human beings and to engage in meaningful ways with other human beings. Even what you mentioned, Chris, of like going through the longer line versus the self-checkout. Just the ways that we can honor other image bearers, even with a simple conversation, in a way that helps the world be a more hospitable place. And that maybe reduces someone's loneliness or gives a bright spot in their day, you know? There's people in my life that I'm just amazed at their ability to just like strike up a conversation with somebody and that person is just really encouraged or blessed by the fact that someone asked them about their life or, you know, like there's just a beauty in the opportunity God gives us here to, as you guys said, live on mission and also live a life of openness to others. So in a century, in a time where less and less people are doing that, the way we do that and how we do that can be much more of a beautiful picture of what the gospel makes possible.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own churches for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thanks for listening in. And we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We always love to hear from listeners. So if you have thoughts, questions, future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.